Susie Snowflake dressed in a snow white gown. Tap, tap, tapping at your window pane to tell you she's in town. Here comes Susie Snowflake. Susie.
And as usual, we've talked about most of this business stuff before the show.
When you open the device, the application here, you should just start recording.
I should.
Before I even get there, and then that way, all of that, and then yeah, that's what we should do from now on.
We're of course, you know, so on the 10th is when Tim and I are going to sit down with a room full of, I don't know, 40 or 50 other LAFCA members and get cranky and, you know, spend. I mean, we have to be done by 4:30, though, because we're renting the room.
Yeah, thank God.
So 9, 10, 11, 12, so 4, 5. That's 7 hours. You think we can get it done in 7 hours?
Well, we have before, not often, but not often.
Oh my gosh. Anyway, no, we've just been seeing a lot of the awards contenders. I'm trying to narrow my choice. Like, I mean, in fairness, I'm not going to name any names, but the emails that go back and forth, we've been making fun of this. The emails that go back and forth, you know, between LAFCA members, there are a certain group that dominates them. Let's just say that there are maybe 5, 6, 7 names out of about 70. And we may get 40 or 50 who show up to the meeting that really sort of dominate all the discussion. And I'm kind of, you know, paying very loose attention. But when somebody recommends a 4.5-hour foreign film to me because it's significant in the continuum related to a previous 13.5-hour movie, I have not seen the 13.5-hour movie. Never gonna. No. 4.5-hour movie? No, no, no. Killers of the Flower Moon, that's where I draw the line. I've seen too many movies that are 2.5, 3 hours. Oppenheimer, 3, I'm done. I don't have time for this. When I see something like Flora and Son, the John Carney film. Merciful gracious heavenly God, it's 97 minutes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And it's 97 minutes. It's nice and tight. It's a John Carney film doing what he does in every one of those films once.
I loved it.
It's wonderful. It's lovely.
I realize it's Bono's daughter. I know I'm not supposed to say this, but somehow she being Bono's daughter makes me love her even more.
It's just great. It's just great. It's sassy. And yeah, so, you know, we had this big conversation about all of these big movies, which I guess most of them are out now. Most of them are out and people are seeing them now. I guess Maestro, not till the 20th on Netflix, I guess. Is it in the real world
yet? It's in theaters. Maestro's in theaters. And Chicken Run and Wonka don't come out until the 15th.
Okay.
But we can see that we've seen those as well. Already, I'm a big fan of Chicken Run. I know a lot of others aren't, but I thought it was hilarious. Woke my family up laughing at it. And the one that has been screening, but we don't have a screener for yet, is the wrestling one from Sean Durkin.
Iron Claw.
Yeah.
And Origin. Did you get anything for Ava DuVernay's Origin? It's the Ava DuVernay film with Anthony Ellison. It's the adaptation of that.
I've got a link for that, but that's, you know what? I got to be honest, Array, for whatever reason, maybe for budgets, because it's a small distributor, but they haven't really pushed a lot.
Not a big marketing situation, just Anthony Ellison, who they're, but yeah, so I would like to see that.
You know, before the show, we were having a biopic conversation. We're talking about films like Maestro and Rustin, which are competent biopics, you know, for made by and for Netflix, but they're like, my wife has a way of, she says the Netflix films, they feel like TV movies. Like even if they're big budget, even if they're very slick, they don't feel like they're made for big audience in a theater. Like there's a thing when you're making a movie and you know, it's going to be on a 50-foot screen and you know, there's going to be 500, 600, 800, maybe 1,000 people packed together watching it. You kind of build the emotions in. You build in the laugh lines. You build in the cheer moments. You know, you build in things that make people gasp. You build all that in. And if you have now a different mindset where you think, oh, I need to hook them in the first 5 minutes or else they're going to turn it off. Well, that's a streaming thing now. People in a movie theater aren't going to walk out in 5 minutes. So you don't need to hook them as quickly. You can build more slowly. With streaming, you got to get in. You got to give them something right up at the top. And you don't build in those big emotional moments because you're sitting alone at home with maybe, you know, two other people tops. So it's more about maintaining interest throughout. So the whole rhythm of the story, the focus of the story, tends to be smaller and more even-handed and less cinematic. They just do. And I think that affects both those films.
Right, well, absolutely. It's an interesting thing because it's two things. One harkens back to the old thing, back before television went 16 by 9. So back, yeah. before television went 16 yeah. by 9, it was 133, that little sort of square box in there. And there was a style of directing that was developed for directing on television.
Yeah.
And you know, and anybody who grew up watching television that in that entire period and knows that, and there was a thing that that cinematographers, directors, filmmakers had to start to understand how to do, how to, they had to make television more visually cinematic as the shape of the frame changed. So you know, 2009, yeah. I guess is when that happened, sort of super duper officially, right? Something yeah. like that. And so that changed, but this is what didn't change. The shape of the box changed, but the nature of the storytelling for television didn't change. Television is an episodic medium. Television is an episodic medium. Even the TV movies that they used to make back in the day, the TV movies, they were shaped like episodes. Your movies of the week, and then you would watch them. Television is an episodic medium. I say television, I mean streaming television, you know, whatever you're watching it on, you know, so television is a metaphor for all of the streaming. It's an episodic medium. And I do not sit down in front of that to give it 2.5 hours sitting there. I'm going to give this 30 minutes, 45 minutes, whatever it is, you know, and I needed to hit these certain beats at certain moments, like a television episode always did.
Yeah.
They always did. Mannix, are you kidding me? Do I even have to talk about the Wild Wild West? They literally would cut to the box and they would put the cartoon and freeze the frame of where all the characters were and what they were doing in this moment so that they could go to the commercial so that you could, they would come back and there they are, all still frozen, and we go again.
And see, this is why I've appreciated that certain films have insisted that that we see them projected. Like, you know, Color Purple really, really pushed it right up until the end before they made it possible for us to see it on a link, because they wanted to get people into a theater. Look, I sat there with Mark and his wife watching it at the Academy, first public screening of Color Purple in that theater that seats 1,100 people. Mm-hmm. And dude, people cheered and they applauded and the movie is beautifully shot up there, and it just, and then, you know, then Oprah and the cast come out and the director come out and they're up there, and then it's over, and they've got us, and we're like, I'm loving this evening. I'm having a grand old time at the movies. If my first exposure to Color Purple had been at home on a link where I'm not feeling 1,000 people around me all cheering and applauding at designated moments when the filmmakers want that movie to have that effect, I am missing a huge part of that experience. So that's what I think award season, you know, those are the pitfalls. I don't know. What are you loving right now? Is there anything that you're just nuts over?
It's I really thoroughly enjoyed some of the smaller films. I really thoroughly enjoyed Past Lives. Really thoroughly enjoyed Anatomy of a Fall. It's a bit of a Perry Mason kind of thing, but that performance by Sandra Hüller is actually very, very good. Love that. That Aki Kaurismäki film, that Finnish film.
Fallen Leaves. Fallen or whatever Leaves.
I'm sort of roaming through all of these smaller films and feeling some performances and feeling some storylines that are sort of interesting, because they represent people that I actually get. American Fiction, I mean, my God, it's at the top of my list, by the way. American Fiction.
So good.
Jefferson Cord's film.
For me, it's the films with the really strong scripts. It's American Fiction and The Holdovers. Alexander Payne came roaring back with it after that, you know, the Matt Damon thing with little shrinky people. That thing.
Downsizing.
Yeah. That bombed. Man, he came roaring back doing what he does. I think The Holdovers is amazing. Amazing. I think American Fiction is one of the just most beautifully written screenplays. And I emailed you guys this too, you know, because they send us the screenplays too. Cord Jefferson is a wonderful writer. Very often you will see a film and you go, oh, that's a great screenplay. And then you read the actual script and you go, it's actually not such a great, like the script became a good movie. There are good structural things, but as a piece of literature, as a piece of prose reading the script, very oftentimes it's just like, it's a little painful. Cord Jefferson writes a beautiful screenplay. Reading it, reading what he has written on the page, it's not just about the dialogue, it's his stage direction. You know, it's the way that he makes it a pleasure to read on the page. And that comes through in the film because I'm reading some of those scenes and I'm like, the scene reads beautifully. But what Jeffrey Wright does with it is even better. So he takes something that's already been beautifully composed and then just spins it into even greater gold. So that is a wonderful thing. The Holdovers, it's beautifully shot. The music selection is eccentric and weird and wonderful. Paul Giamatti. Been good.
Coming back to Alexander. Let me ask you this. Why is Air nobody's talking about Air.
On mine. That's getting all kinds of love from me.
Yeah, me too. But I just, I'm doing this thing. I do this thing with the LA Times. It's called the Buzz Meter thing. You can see it on the LA Times.
I love the fact that I know literally everyone. I open it to that page and I look at it and I go, oh, look, there's Tim and there's Claudia and there's Anne and, you know, I know all of you, and there's Glenn and there's Justin. I know every single person on that page.
I hate my picture in that thing. But Air, no love there. And I which may just have to do with distance and time and whatever. But, you know, because with Air, you get another really good screenplay. You get a really good supporting performance from Ben. Oh, and you get this really good lead performance from Matt. You got a whole bunch of stuff to me in Air.
Incredible supporting performances.
Chris Tucker. Is it Chris Tucker?
Oh, Chris Tucker is great in it, too. And even Jason Bateman.
Jason
Bateman is like barely in the
thing. Who's the guy that plays Michael's agent? I forget his name. He was in Kelling show for years. You know what I'm talking about, but he's amazing. Not to forget Viola, who gives a
Christmasina.
Thank you very much. So I'm looking at Air and I'm like, I see all kinds of nominations in this one movie.
I was standing behind Christmasina in line at the Killers of the Flower Moon premiere.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I was texting Mark at the time. I was like, I'm behind Christmasina. Do I tell him how much I loved him in Air, or do I just shut up and not be a geek? It was very funny. But we wound up in the same line because our last names both begin with M.
Oh, yeah.
So there we go.
So there are a lot of these things. Dude, I love, The Burial.
I like The Burial too. I like The Burial very much. I don't know if it's an awards film.
I hang around over there with my boys and
it's
people.
Almost too much fun.
Well, because Jamie is so good at it. This is the thing about Jamie Foxx in The Burial. If you know, I happen to know the person that he's playing, who's still alive,
dude, I used to see those commercials.
Jamie,
those commercials.
Nails that guy. He's like, you're that guy. For that matter, Tommy Lee Jones is actually very good in that movie. Yeah. So little movies like that, and let me just say this, dude, in the black community, They Clone Tyrone is the best movie of the year. Period. And it kind of really is. And again, Jamie Foxx. So it'll be interesting. I always notice this this time of the year that, you know, these sort of movies, Past Lives, this wonderful film. And I know that the Asian community really, really loves this film. And I like Past Lives too.
Yep.
But I don't know that it is at the top of my list.
There are very few films that are kind of filtering to the very, very top, to the cream of the crop. American Fiction, Holdovers, Air, Color Purple. I'm trying to think what else is really up there for me. It's been a good year. It hasn't been a great year. The films are really great. The ones that just fly, like Flora and Son, I love, but I don't know that it's going to get any love.
But that's the kind of thing I mean. So Flora and Son, I get it. These little bitty films with all this kind of stuff. And I don't know. Sometimes I feel like, well, if the love factor of a film, you know, how much actual people love it.
Yeah.
If that, how much should we weigh that in? I know it's not all about a popularity contest, not just about a popularity contest, but I do think something about how much actual people love a film, how much I actually love a film, how much I enjoyed it, how much it lingers with me. I think all of that should weigh more than we give it sometimes.
I think so. I agree.
You know, I mean, I just love Flora and Son. And And if that all by itself don't make it award worthy, I'm not sure what the hell does.
It's just, she, and this is in the trailer too, but it's still one of the biggest laughs in the movie. When she comes into his room and he's looking at his iPad and she goes, "What are you doing?" And it's the Irish lilt too. Mm-hmm. The Irish accent just makes things funnier. The British accent makes things funnier. In Chicken Run, the fact that you have chickens with teeth speaking in a Yorkshire accent and saying love after every line, well, that's all right, love. Love. I laugh. They could be taking out the trash. I don't care. I laugh. When she comes in, she goes, "So what are you doing?" And he goes, "You don't want to know." He's sitting there staring at his iPad. That's a funny line. It's funny. I wanted to be in an audience. I wanted to be around like 600 people laughing at the same time. So I mean, it's you know, it all begins. We got to have our Critics' Choice ballot in at the end of the week. So I have to see everything by then, anyway.
Well, yeah, well, the critic—that's different because you know we're not in the room all together voting. It's a thing that happens online, and you could just and this the CAA or what is it? CCA. It's different in this way. You don't have, you know, the other 75, 80, 100 members of the, I guess there's several hundred members of that, coming at you, you know, with their ideas and their thoughts and their feelings and some notion that, you know, I don't know, whatever it is. You just get a ballot and you fill in your picks and you're done.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like
yeah.
That. Yeah.
Yep. Indeed. Well, let's start off. This is our holiday show and we've got so much cool stuff, but, I want to start off with like all the Criterion and the Radiance stuff. This is the elite box sets this season. Mostly from Criterion and also from their newish line, which is, the Janus Contemporaries, because Janus, and just so everybody understands, so Janus Films, quick little history.
Oh yeah,
back in the 1950s and 60s, Janus Films was founded by a couple of New York attorneys as to distribute a lot of foreign language films, Ingmar Bergman and Akira Kurosawa, and you name it, you know, a lot of foreign stuff that was becoming hot around the world, didn't really have a way of reaching American theaters. So Janus was formed, and Janus distributed those films. Those two attorneys would go on to have sons. Their sons founded the Criterion Collection and still run it. So that's why Janus and the Criterion Collection are basically affiliated brands. It's you know, fathers and sons. That's what goes on there. So anyway, Janus Contemporaries, they still own the rights to all those movies. So, you know, Janus is still a theatrical distributor. So it works hand in hand with Criterion. So they've released the Janus Contemporaries line. So I'm going to start off with this really great Radiance box set from Radiance Films, radiancefilms.us. This is three films by Damiano Damiani. What a great name, right?
Beautiful.
And it's Cosa Nostra. And these are three films that they're not The Godfather. I don't want anybody to think that, but there's only 3,000 copies of this, and it includes The Day of the Owl, The Case is Closed, Forget It, and last one, How to Kill a Judge. And this is all just Franco Nero.
Franco Nero, baby. Yeah.
Franco Nero just looking good. And yeah, these are mob movies, but you know what? They're Franco Nero movies. Mm-hmm. You're watching this so that you can watch Franco just be Franco and be just badass and cool. And they're really fun.
I love the, and yeah, of course, it's reminiscent of the artwork of the one sheets from the period.
Right.
On each one of these boxes, just gorgeous artwork on each
it's
one of these
boxes. Yeah. It's good stuff. And Franco Nero, come on. I mean, you know, he and Vanessa Redgrave, it's the epic romance of all time. How do you not get behind that? And yet the one movie they made significantly together, Camelot, they have no chemistry in. I've never understood that. One of the great all-time Criterion Collection releases that keeps coming back on Criterion Channel. We now finally have it as a 4K Director's Edition. Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven. I cannot get enough of this movie. I love this movie. And you know what? There was, I hate to just attack our colleagues in LAFCA, but there was an email that came out talking about a wonderful little independent film this year called All Roads.
Taste of Dirt or Taste of Salt or something like that.
Salt. That's it. Yeah. All Roads, Taste of Salt. Not the greatest title, but it makes sense when you watch the movie. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, oh, it's like a close to a Tarkovsky film. It is not a Tarkovsky film. It is a Malick film. I said, if Malick were a young black woman in the South, that film would be Tree of Life. Mm-hmm. That's basically her Tree of Life. It's a wonder. Anyway, it's a little like Days of Heaven too. It has that that lyrical, just wonderful kind of dreamlike way of floating through a particularly rural autobiographical narrative. Anyway, Days of Heaven is superb and wonderful, and I love this film.
Young Richard Gere, dude. Richard Gere. Yeah, that's ridiculous, and it's just really, really good. Sam Shepard,
It's so lovely. It takes place in the 1910s. The movie was made in 1978. It's a superb film.
Richard Libertini, who used to live up the hill from you, I think, right? Didn't Richard just live up the hill?
Yeah. I mean, a close friend. His son is one of my oldest friends. It's a beautiful movie. Days of Heaven, absolutely fantastic. 4K, lots of great stuff from Criterion on that one. And then from the Janus Contemporaries line is a movie that is in our awards mix, Godland. Mm-hmm. And I covered that on radio. I don't know that I'm as enamored of Godland as some are, but I have an appreciation for it. This is a rather long movie, a 2.5 hour long movie about... it's one of those Nordic movies where suffering, relentless suffering. Yeah. It's almost like you just want to say to these people, why did you even move to that part of the planet if you're just going to sit there and be cold and suffer and starve all the time?
Yeah, well, that's why.
So they can make movies about it.
Yeah, that's why.
No, this is about a Danish priest in the late 19th century who goes to Iceland to build a church, and it doesn't go well.
Look, there's way too much sort of extremely literal imagery in this film. You know, he's wandering around. He has this stuff on his back, that chair with the pyres that come out to go above his head that look like the pillars of a great cathedral, like as though he's literally carrying the church on his back.
Yeah.
And I'm like, really? Yeah. Really, you gotta, I'm like, okay, whatever. But and, you know, another thing is irritating.
Go ahead.
No.
I was gonna say the better film of that type for me is The Promised Land.
Okay,
which is also a Danish film, mm-hmm. but that's the one with Mads Mikkelsen. Mm-hmm. Nicholas Arcel wrote it or directed it, and it was co-written by Anders Thomas Jensen, the great Danish screenwriter. I mean, that takes place in the 1755, and that is a killer of a movie. It's one of my favorite films of the year. I don't know if anybody else is going to vote for it, but he basically plays this old soldier guy who became a captain, even though he was born a peasant. And the northern part of Denmark at that time is just all swampland. It's like all just sandy dirt and swampland. You can't grow anything in it. But the king wants to reward some people who can grow in it. So he goes there to make his way, but he runs head on into this wealthy landowner who wants to drive him out. And I'm thinking, okay, it's a Western. It's basically Unforgiven. You know, the wealthy landowner wants to drive him out. The wealthy homesteader, the young homesteader is going to be driven out by the land baron. And so it's a Western. It's a little bit Unforgiven, but it's also a little bit Jean de Florette, right?
It is a biography. I mean, that guy existed. I love that movie. It was great, but you're right. I don't know if anybody's going to be talking about it so much. I dug it.
Also on 4K, Peter Bogdanovich's Last Picture Show. Oh my gosh, this movie still holds up.
Now, the 4K, I haven't seen the 4K. Yeah. And sometimes I find that when black and white is brought to 4K, that it becomes
a little too crisp.
Thank you. So you tell me.
Nope. The Criterion is very attentive to that. The grain is still there. The contrast is perfect. You do have to make sure that your TV is in cinema mode. I will say that, because if it's switched over to that sports mode where it over.
Oh my God.
It will kill the black and white.
Yeah.
So make sure that your television is in the right mode, and then the black and white is just beautiful. But once you when it overdrives the picture, that's bad enough in color. But man, in black and white, like you're looking at a negative.
Oh, yes, it becomes like silhouettes. It's terrible.
Another one from Janus Contemporaries is The Eight Mountains. This is also in our awards mix. I'm not such a fan of this, to be honest. And it doesn't have much by way of extras. It's, you know, got a little documentary featurette and some interviews. But this takes place in the Alps in Italy. And, it's kind of an allegory about friendship and all that.
But it doesn't have the humor of what was that one did what's his name did with last year. Where the guy cuts off his finger. You know what I'm talking about. This doesn't have that.
Yeah.
This takes place over 40 years. This friendship over 40 years.
Claude Chabrol's La Cérémonie with Sandrine Bonnaire and Isabelle Huppert from 1995, just a great late stage Chabrol movie with two amazing actresses. Phenomenal. Can't say enough about this. It's sort of the quintessential Chabrol film. I love it. Yeah. I've done a lot of commentaries for Chabrol films with some of our colleagues, with Andy and some others. None of those are on here. It is now Criterion though, and it's a Blu-ray, not a 4K, but it's absolutely terrific. Get it for Christmas, get it for Hanukkah, get it for whomever. Moonage Daydream. How did you feel about Moonage Daydream? That's out on 4K now too.
I don't know if I know. Did I get that one?
Oh, that was the Bowie doc.
Oh, well, you know, yeah. That was interesting. Because there were a couple of those films that came out.
Yeah.
This one I thought was probably the most personal one. The one that seemed to be exploring him.
That's the one.
More than the music in and of itself. So I kind of liked it. What did you think?
I'm lukewarm on it. I don't know. I think I probably need a little bit more distance from Bowie personally. I know he's been gone for, you know, a number of years now.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, well, a lot of people died that year. That was the year that we lost, you know, Prince. That was the year that we lost George Michael. Mm. Remember, that was the year that like everybody died.
We 2015. I
kind of don't feel like I'm yet ready to sort of revisit any of those people.
Well, this film was the one that was sanctioned by the Bowie estate. Yeah. Whatever the hell that, I'm not really sure what that means.
I don't know either.
But whenever I hear it, it always makes me suspect.
Yeah.
Rather than just, that sort of lives in that space.
We also have La Bamba, the Luisa Valdez, speaking of biopics, Richie Valens biopic with Lou Diamond Phillips. I love this movie. I enjoy it immensely. I think it dates pretty well.
Mm.
It's a little
87, I think. 86, 87.
87. 87. I mean, it still feels right. I love the way that it sort of depicts that period in California, the 1950s. And I love the way that it depicts that particular period in you know, the emergence of rock and roll. I think it's just a really sweet film that is out on Blu-ray from Criterion, as is an amazing Blu-ray box set here of Todd Browning's Sideshow Shockers. Now, Todd Browning, of course, the filmmaker behind Freaks most famously. Mm. And this includes more than just Freaks. This includes Freaks, The Unknown, and The Mystic. Browning is not that well known for some of the other films, so this gives you a better snapshot of his of his work overall. And The Mystic has been really hard to see for a very long time. So these have all been meticulously restored. This is all from, you know, the silent era into the early sound era.
Well pre-code, I think.
Todd Browning would have been, there's a reason he disappears once the code comes around, because he just kind of shrugged and said, well, what do you want me to do with this?
Yeah.
I can't work with these rules. No, but it's a really weird, eerie moment, and a lot of great extras here that kind of give you, you know, shed some light on who Browning was, why he made the films that he made. There's a really interesting backstory to all of this. Anyway,
a lot of the stuff in this box says too. They spent some time on some of the very interesting people that were working behind the scenes on a whole lot of these films. I mean, not just the stars, Joan Crawford or whoever in the things, but the production designers and all. It's just because a lot of those people were so like notable folks, you know.
Yep. Got a couple more 4Ks here. I'll mention in just one breath. Orson Welles' The Trial, based on the Franz Kafka novel, which is, you know, one of the. I mean, everyone loves this movie. Anthony Perkins is amazing in it. Mm. I've always felt like this was the inspiration for Steven Soderbergh's Kafka.
Mm.
Very much so. I think this is the film that he watched and he wanted to kind of do something that was very, very referential of it, made in 1962. So heavily overshadowed by Lawrence of Arabia and all the other movies that came out in 62. But a really, really great movie. Amazing on 4K as long as the TV's not overdriving.
Right, same situation with the black and white.
It's just spectacular.
Well, it's one of those films where Orson was sort of persona non grata at that period again in Hollywood. Yeah. And he goes to where? Is it Poland? It's someplace.
I can't remember.
And he scrapes together. If I'm not mistaken, a few of the bucks for this movie came from the Salkins. Who would go on, you know, with the Superman movies and all that. So they gave him a few bucks, and he just went to some of those stark post-war, and he would just shoot, you know, these long, wide shots, and he had these little rooms with Anthony Perkins. I really love that movie. It's really great.
Well, and then as long as we're in the Kafka realm, there is something that's more than a little Kafka-esque with this other 4K from Criterion. Don't Look Now, the very controversial Nicholas Roeg film from 1973 with Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie, based on the Daphne du Maurier story. Mm. It is eerie. It is creepy. It is, it's about a British couple in Venice, but it's not the Venice of your dreams. It's the Venice of your nightmares. It is a very Kafka-esque way of, telling Du Maurier tale, a little bit of Hitchcockian, I guess. And sexual in ways that even in 1973 were considered,
fairly explicit.
I don't know about that. Anyway, there's a great 2002 documentary on here, looking back on the film and the director and, you know, Nicholas Roeg, for those who don't know, you know, his movies are an acquired taste. Mm. Roeg started as a cinematographer. He was actually one of the camera operators in Lawrence of Arabia. If you look in the credits, you'll be like, oh, look, there's Nicholas Roeg. And then Lean elevated him to cinematographer for Dr. Zhivago. And I think they may have worked together for like 16 seconds when Lean said, I don't think our visions are really going to mesh on this. And so they agreed to go their separate ways. And Roeg then went on to shoot Mask of the Red Death for Corman. And then pretty soon he was making weird stuff like this.
Man of Fell Earth, all that kind of stuff. You know, there's some interesting stuff in there.
A lot of interesting stuff. So it's one of Roeg's more commercial films, but still pretty intense and weird. Want to make mention of a couple of interesting foreign films here. The first one is Dry Long So, which is not a foreign film, but an intense indie film from the 1990s that I was not aware of at the time.
Yeah,
98. Made by Colleen Smith, and takes place in Oakland. It is maybe the most Oakland indie film you have ever seen. Basically about, you know, just black life in Oakland in the 1990s, which is a really intense moment. And this movie is made for $1.50.
Yeah.
Very, very, very interesting film. I didn't even, did you catch this when it came out?
Oh yeah. Back in 98. Yeah. Because it was one of the independent, it was an indie spirit award fave back then. I was running out of it. It was just really neat, really neat little movie. Salim Akil is in this film. Salim Akil will go on to do all kinds of interesting things and as a producer and all kinds of stuff. It's a really, really neat movie. It's about this young black photographer girl and roaming around.
But it's a nice genre. It's like a little bit of a mystery. It's a little bit of a comedy. It's like a snapshot of life in a way that defies genre. And it's very interesting. Nikyatu Jusu. I'm sure I'm totally destroying the name. Nikyatu Jusu made Nanny in 2022. Mm. And, this is a Senegalese film that is set in New York City. Mm-hmm. So basically the story of a Senegalese immigrant working for a family in New York City. And you think that this is a Sundance film, by the way. You think that this is basically going to be kind of one of those movies about cultural and ethnic dislocation. But it winds up being something very different. It's not a fish out of water movie in any comedic or even dramatic sense. It's much more almost a coming of age film.
Yeah,
but a coming of age film that takes place in a in a in a in a in a hostile or even a strange environment.
It's a horror movie for one thing. It's an actual horror movie, but the horror is like it's both real and both about that these people in this environment.
It is. It's called Nanny, and it is. It got the Criterion treatment, even though it was made in 2022, so it's a recent film. And the filmmaker is Nkyatu Jusu, but it is a. It is a fascinating film. I mean, it's again, this is like a genre splice because it is about the ordeal of being in a of. Coming of age in a dislocated environment. And I think the horror is very much an allegorical commentary about that process. Anyway,
Anna, the lead in this, she plays Corey in Titans, in case people want to make a connection with her, because she's fantastic. She's so beautiful. It's insane how beautiful she is. And I think Michelle Monaghan's walked around this film too, but Anna, she's Corey in Titans.
Got another 4K Nicholas Rogue film. This one is much more accessible and more famous, actually, and that is The Great Walkabout. Which I just absolutely adore. Beautiful score, beautiful music at the same time. John Barry. It's really just a fantastic film. Super simple film. So this is a film about an Aboriginal boy and a young Australian woman who meet. And basically it is that kind of people coming from opposite sides of culture, opposite sides of life experience, and sharing a moment. And the walkabout is a thing that the tribal Aboriginals do. It's their coming of age thing. It's like consider it like a lot harder than a bar mitzvah, like a lot harder. But you know, you sort of have to go out and survive and prove that you can, you know, live on your own and all this kind of stuff. And it's an ancient thing, and it's a you know what this kid is doing. It's his passage to manhood. And I just think the world of this film. It is deeply, deeply moving. I think a lot of that is because men of our generation had a thing for Jenny Agutter.
Well, that for sure.
And you could pretty much put Jenny Agutter in anything, and we were going to love it. So, but she is luminous here. And David Gopalil, you know, who this was one of his first performances as the young man, was absolutely fantastic. I mean, it really is. It's a magical movie. It's a magical movie.
Even back in 1971, this movie was noted for the fact that it respected the knowledge of the Aboriginal people of you know, this little Aboriginal boy is capable of not only doing this thing that they all Aboriginal boys were going to do. He keeps these two kids alive, and he is the thing there. So it was a film that on that scale looked at this culture and said, this culture knows things that we don't know. And that's a thing that was going on in this movie that I really appreciated, both at the time, and I kind of think that it continues to do that in a certain sort of way.
I'm going to give us four more 4Ks here from Criterion. One of which, The Princess Bride, has absolutely beautiful special packaging, like looks like a little book, and it's beautiful. Really nice. But here's what we got on 4K. We got The Princess Bride. We got Alejandro Amenábar's The Others with Nicole Kidman, Martin Scorsese's Immortal Mean Streets, and Cronenberg's Videodrome. We all know these movies. They are loaded with extras. They all look great. But, Tim, you know, that's an interesting collection of movies. The Princess Bride... from Rob Reiner, who's now going to do a sequel to Spinal Tap, which is weird. The others by Alejandro Amenábar, who has disappeared despite being hugely successful. His career just evaporated.
The Others was 2001. That's more than 20. Yeah.
I mean, you know, where did he go?
Yeah.
And Mean Streets, of course, you know, from the man who just gave us the turgid 3.5 hour Goes to the Flower Moon. And Cronenberg's Videodrome. He's become an old man telling people to get off his lawn. What do we make of these four movies and their filmmakers now at this point in their in cinema history and their careers?
Well, let's see. Well, you just mentioned that Rob Reiner is going to do that sequel, you know, which is just a terrible idea. So I think that I think that speaks to that. You know, why would you sully that perfect thing you did? Not only would I not make a sequel to that, I would not allow anybody else to do it either. No. There, as you just said, the others, Aminabar. I don't know. You good. Point just kind of, you know, boom, gone, went away. Yeah. I mean, Open Your Eyes. He did that thing with The Sea Inside. The Sea Inside. Yeah. I don't know.
What an Oscar for The Sea Inside. I mean, he's a major filmmaker. I just don't know what happened there.
But even The Sea Inside is 20 years ago. That's 2004. I'm just like, so, you know, I don't know. In 1983 Videodrome, I got to tell you, this was genius filmmaking. It's just, it was like hands-on, all practical effects filmmaking from Cronenberg, Debbie Harry and James Wood. Way all back in 1983, sure. All practical effects, and you know, and Cronenberg and his career, and here we are now. So his kid kind of picked up where he left off, though.
Also, real quickly, a couple of great foreign language films from Radiance. One is A Moment of Romance by Benny Chan, the fantastic Benny Chan, and The Dead Mother by Juanma Bajo Ulloa. Obviously one is in Cantonese, one is in Spanish. I'll let you figure out which one. Loaded with extras on here. Yeah, you know, it's
Andy Lau, dude.
Yeah. Moments for Romance is just really, it's a great Hong Kong crime classic. It's just really, really solid. It's right in the pocket of that genre. Andy Lau has not aged in the last 75 years. I don't know what his secret is. I really don't. The Dead Mother is just this really, really kind of dark, darkly humorous thriller with all kinds of really creepy, creepy edges in it. As you would expect from a movie called The Dark Mother. It is really kind of disturbing in the way that I don't know anyone who's ever suffered a home invasion, robbery, or a break-in or anything like that. But this makes the whole, it takes that concept and it just escalates it to borderline horror. It is quite a ride, but it is a dark and creepy ride. From the Janus Contemporaries line, we have the amazing French film The Innocent, which was just hugely, hugely successful in France. Tons of awards, tons of recognition. It's directed by Louis Garrel. It's very French, though. It didn't do particularly well here. And I think largely that's because it has a very dark humorous streak in it that you almost have to speak French to understand. It doesn't communicate in the subtitles. It is deeply, deeply cultural. But boy, it all of the stuff about what, you know, men do to win the love of women and to please their mothers. It's a pretty crazy ride. Especially if you speak French, it is just a blast and a great script.
Emma Stone shows up in that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, she does. She does. And then we also have EO, which won won a bunch of awards from us last year. I still don't get it, dude. It's a donkey movie.
Benji with a donkey.
It is. It's Benji with a donkey. I don't get it. Why did our group go nuts for this?
They found these sort of deep meanings there that are there, but they were there in all those Benji movies too. I mean, the Benji movies. So whatever.
Well, anyway. Our LA Film Critics went nuts for this movie by Jerzy Skolimowski last year. It's based on the Bresson film, about the donkey, and it's kind of a riff on that. And I guess I don't know, I don't get it. No Bears, the Jafar Panahi movie. A lot of people have been loving that this year, but then it suddenly disappeared in our conversation. So I'm not sure how many people actually saw it. But, you know, Jafar Panahi just keeps making movies, even though he's not supposed to. And this was a pretty great one. So Yeah. We should support it if we can by any possible means. It's also a visit. You can watch either of those films, EO and No Bears, on the Criterion Channel. And then the Dardenne brothers made another lovely movie, but that's kind of par for the course with them. Mm. Some of them work better for me than others. Tori and Lokita, I thought, was on the better end of what they've been doing lately, and it is mercifully short. It's 89 minutes. That thing is just in and out. Did you see Tori and Lokita?
Yeah, yeah. Talked about that on the radio show. It's a very powerful film about these young black girl and a young black boy,
African
immigrants, and what they're going through. In Belgium. Ostensibly brother and sister, but the story becomes more complicated than that.
Yeah,
it's quite dire, beautifully acted, very powerful. But you know,
a lot of really interesting movies. We've talked about this too, like the French film about the chef. These interesting movies about the experiences of specifically Northwest African immigrants in Francophone countries where they used to have colonial connections. It's a very, very specific school of drama now, but it's emerging in Belgium and in France. And they're kind of, you know, wrestling with a lot of this because these populations are coming more and more there. The economies are increasingly at parity. You're not getting just refugees and economic refugees. You're getting people with skills who are, you know, moving into all kinds of skilled opportunities and jobs in those economies where they are needed. And it's creating a really interesting dynamic. It's not, I wouldn't say it's creating stresses, but it's changing the culture, and it's changing it in ways that I think are really interesting. I like Tori and Lokita very, very much. And then the last one of this batch is Jackie Chan, Emergence of a Superstar. Mm. I, of course, a million years ago, wrote a Jackie Chan coffee table book. I've spent a lot of time interviewing Jackie and on the set of Rush Hour 2, I guess it was at the time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I saw Brett Ratner direct or try to direct, whatever he calls directing. Quite a thing. Anyway, this is a bunch of early stuff. This is these are movies that come from that early period before the Hong Kong New Wave really takes off, before he really kind of between the original Drunken Master and Police Story. And this is Half a Loaf of Kung Fu, Spiritual Kung Fu, The Fearless Hyena 1 and 2, The Young Master, which was sort of when Jackie showed his chops as a director for the first time. Like there are some incredible set pieces in The Young Master. And then My Lucky Stars, which is one of the first of his really fun comedy kung fu films.
Sammo.
Gosh. It's all so many. I mean, the extras here are just absolutely terrific. Frank Jang from who wrote Enter the Clones of Bruce shows up in here for an interview. So does Grady Hendrix, who wrote These Fists Break Bricks, which we've covered on this podcast. A lot of other stuff, just interviews and featurettes and really, really great stuff. So they include original language tracks as well as the English dub tracks, and these are all late 70s to kind of mid 80s. Great collection of movies, great box set, gotta get it. Jackie is not where he used to be, but you know, it's good stuff.
Yeah.
Shall we get into the box TV sets?
Groovy.
Yeah.
The movie boxes. Let's start with the movie boxes because that Sunday Chiba collection is at the top of top of that list.
As long as we're on that subject.
Yeah. I'd love to see what's in that Sunday Chiba box.
Yeah, Sunday Chiba. Let me pull Sunny out over here. Yeah, Sonny is.
Is this the one out of Shout Factory, the Volume 2?
Yep. Yes, it is indeed. Yep. Sonny Chiba, Volume 2. Another legend of the genre, along with Jackie. This includes The Defensive Power of Aikido, 13 Steps of Maki, Karate Warriors, The Great Okinawa Yakuza War. I mean, come on. How do you not want to see a movie about a Yakuza War in Okinawa? It's the great one as opposed to the not so great one. Karate for Life, Group 13, Assignment Kowloon. And The Okinawa War of 10 Years. So apparently, you know, there were two wars. One was a Yakuza war and the other one lasted 10 years. No, wow. I have not seen all of these, but I've seen a couple of them, like the like Karate Warriors is an awful lot of fun. That's from 1976. And the Defensive Power of Aikido from the year before is really great. You don't really learn anything about Aikido. You don't really learn about its power, much less its defensive power. It's a great title, but it's still a fun film. It's still a really fun film. And this is a great box set. It's from Shout Select, volume 149. And yeah, it's terrific.
The Carry On collection. What's that? Volume 2 that we have coming up here?
Yeah, so there are the Carry On films. There's a million of them. And we talked about the documentary on Jeremy Thomas last week. And Jeremy Thomas's uncle directed all these movies, just so everybody knows. So there's a million of these movies. This is the second volume. Just making a mention, there are three of these volumes. This is from ViaVision in Australia. It's the best place that you're going to get. It's the only place you're going to get it from on Blu-ray. So it's worth looking it up as an import and getting these things, because the Carry On films are just a riot. Get all three volumes. We got volume 2 here, which includes Carry On Cabbie, Carry On Cruising, Carry On Regardless, and Carry On Jack, which is one of my favorites. I love Carry On Jack. Look, here's the deal. The plots here really don't matter. This is just great, kind of swanky working class British comedy, and it was an opportunity for a lot of really good screenwriters and some wonderful actors to just be funny. Not sophisticated comedy. This is just good old fashioned. This is like a half a notch above Benny Hill.
Yeah.
And these movies are absolutely wonderful. And you see so many fantastic actors here, and you think, why'd that person never make other movies? Because they were making Carry On movies. That's why.
Becoming a part of the national, whatever. It's just, in the UK, this would be, I don't even know what, as compared to
Police Academy.
Police Academy, something like that.
Yeah, it'd be like the Police Academy movies, basically. Yeah, except, more sophisticated, and you don't have, Michael Winslow going
I know we got the that John Wick chapters 1 through 4, but the Shaw Brothers stuff, if you got that handy,
we're in the genre, we're in the zone. This is the Shaw Brothers Classics volume 3. There are two different volume. There are two different Shaw Brothers box sets that are coming out regularly, one from Arrow, which is kind of the elite one, and then this one. But there are a lot of great titles here too. I mean, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 movies, 11 movies on Blu-ray here. The Shaw Brothers stuff has been getting a really, really, beautifully restored, really just pristine, so colorful. These movies are so well shot, and for so many decades they were seen in crappy condition here, like bad prints, and they were scraped up, and they'd already toured 50 different countries and been screened 10,000 times, and they show up on Channel 9 Afternoon Kung Fu Theater and that would be badly made. No, the print just got beat up.
Great
stuff here. So the Shaolin Avengers is, I think, maybe the best of all of these. That's from 1976. We've also got Clan of the White Lotus from 1980, which is a kind of a late stage Shaw Brothers movie, because Shaw Brothers gets sort of Golden Harvest kind of takes over once you get into the 80s. Shaolin Abbot minus Shaolin Castello, oddly enough. No, it's a bad joke. That's from 1979. And then one of my favorites, one of the great kind of feminist Hong Kong titles of the period, The Vengeful Beauty. She is beautiful, and man, is she vengeful. So there's some great stuff here. But it's just, it's basically to just load these films up. If you happen to have a 10-year-old like I do, and you try to do it when your spouse isn't looking and say, look, these are fun movies. Let's watch this.
I love it. The Irwin Allen Master, it's the Master of Disaster Collection.
That's what it is.
Just for the title.
These movies are terrible, and that's what makes it so wonderful. There's nothing. None of the good ones are in. These are the bad ones. Shout, but it's good. It's good bad. This is also from Shout, and they decided to just make a cheesy box, and it's wonderful. It includes the movie. This is all from the 1970s and early 80s. Yeah. So here we are in chronological order. And people are going to be like, really? Irwin Allen made those? Yes,
oh, yeah.
He did. After he got that Oscar nomination for the Towering Inferno and the Poseidon Adventure,
yeah,
he lost his mind and made a bunch of really crappy movies very quickly, which included Flood, mm-hmm, 1976, Fire from 1977. We're just going with one name titles now. Hanging by a Thread. In 1979, which is over 3 hours long.
Yeah,
just dreadful. And then we went back to the well in 79 as well for Beyond the Poseidon Adventure.
Yes,
I don't know how you go beyond something that sinks, but there it is. When Time Ran Out from 1980, The Night the Bridge Fell Down, kind of lowering our expectations now. And then in 1983, my favorite, Cave-In.
With an exclamation point.
Exclamation point.
That's what I'm talking about.
I mean, you know, it's all fun stuff. And you get, you know, like great 70s actors all showing up. They look fine. Sally Field, Paul Newman. William Holden. They all show up in here. It's
great. Yeah. And some of them were kind of at the back end of their, you know, their careers there. Why, but there they were.
Borgnine.
Making TV movies, baby. Yeah.
And then we got the 4 John Wick films, not on 4K. They're all out on 4K, but they haven't given us a 4K box set. They have given us a lovely Blu-ray box set. DVD and Blu-ray, John Wick, chapters 1 through 4. Perfectly serviceable for most people. So,
and to be honest, priced incredibly affordably.
Very much so.
Around $30 or so. If you look around, you can get all four of those. And I think that that's really smart. Really super smart.
Be a Santa.
Mm-hmm.
Be a Santa. Let's see. Should we? So we go on to the 4K movies or
all right, man. TV? Let's roll down and get some TV gun. Right. What do you want to do? The TV boxes?
Let's do the TV boxes.
Because I liked Expanse and you didn't. So if you got that handy, we can talk about what we're getting in that Expanse set there. The series, which, you know, it's to me, it had a sort of interesting sort of overall conception.
Canadian series,
yeah.
We should point
out of Sci-Fi Network over there is where I first saw it.
And it kind of tanked after that season. And then Jeff Bezos said, well, I like the show. So he went and funded it to continue. And it ended up on Amazon. The problem that I have with most of these kinds of shows, the post-Star Trek era shows, is that I don't quite ever buy into the world. So the whole premise of The Expanse is that, you know, we're a couple centuries into the future, right? And we've populated the Martian colonies, but they are kind of like, now it's a caste system. Mm-hmm, all the miners and the poor people and, you know, the outliers, they're part of Mars. And there's a war between, you know, Mars and Earth, and then the people in the asteroid belt.
Mm-hmm,
and
the Deltas,
And there's, you know, so you've kind of taken what would, it feels as though we're basically talking about a skirmish between Canada, the U.S. and Mexico, but we've elevated it to a solar system level.
A solar system wide with sort of space. Look, as you said, Sci-Fi Network 2015 to about 2018. And that story had this whole thing going on with Thomas Jane, who was like sort of real, but sort of not, and a private detective. And this whole very mystical, magical sort of thing going on. And by the time we get to it moving over to Amazon Prime in 2019-ish or so, or something like that, that's when we get to that storyline that you just becomes almost purely a storyline. You know, the solar system wide politics that was meant to reflect the politics of the world. Blah blah blah. That sort of thing. So it was an interesting sort of switch there. 62 episodes altogether. So I don't know. Yeah.
Well, the complete series. Never mind me, because most people really love this show. Seriously, I'm like the outlier. So. I'm like the asteroid belt
the people. Belter, you're a belter.
I'm a belter. So ignore me. What do I know? We also have, as long as we're talking about the wonderful Aardman animation of Chicken Run, Shaun the Sheep, the complete series, is finally out. And this has taken long enough. Man, different people have put out like seasons of this. And anyway, forget it. It's out now, finally, the complete series, and it is a nice little tight box set, so you can watch all of the Shaun the Sheep stuff, which is just still so darn funny. This is a spinoff, of course, from Wallace and Gromit, and they, you know, we had a couple of Shaun the Sheep movies as well, but the series is so, so funny, because it's, Tim, your phrase, bit funny.
Yeah.
Love, that's what this is. Uh-huh. It's just bits. It only needs to be funny in little, like, 30-second chunks. And it is. It's really wonderful stuff. So, you know, my daughter loves this.
Yeah.
Very happy to finally have this at our disposal. Shaun the Sheep. I'm going to get a lot of laughter. The new Nancy Drew. How do you feel about that? Have you watched any of that?
Well, you know, yeah, I did watch that. Yeah. You know, up till the recent season where I think might have closed it out. So it's
four seasons.
Look, this Nancy Drew series was mystical and magical. There were all kinds of ghosts and witches and demons and all of these things. To be honest with you, I really never associated with the Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys stuff. The Hardy Boys series also had that going on. There was a Hardy Boys series recently too here, and that kind of threw me, to be honest with you. That kind of all the witches, it's not just in that, you know, it's crime,
it's not just made for us.
Yeah,
it's made for a generation that is genre attuned. They want genre in everything, including their Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys. Pamela Sue Martin is my Nancy Drew forever. Yep. But I, other than the supernatural stuff, I actually thought that the spirit of the character, if not the spirit of the stories, was well represented in this series. So that's out there too. Four seasons of Nancy Drew on DVD from CBS and Paramount. We also have The Beav.
Yeah, yeah.
Series on Blu-ray, finally from Universal, the complete Leave It to Beaver. And my wife absolutely hates this.
That's funny. I've gone back and forth on this. I'm feeling kind of nostalgic about it these days. Ran from 57 to 63, something like that.
Yeah.
So we get to watch Tony and Jerry, Tony Down, Jerry Mathis, you know, Wally and the Beaver. We get to watch them kind of grow up a little bit. And when I look at that show now, I can see that maturity happen, particularly in Jerry Mathis the Beaver.
Yes,
100%. It's just, and I'm like, this is really well done. This is very sophisticated. And some of those conversations that they had with Ward, dude, I'm sorry. You can take those and break them out, and you have some sort of situation with your kid. You say, hey, you know what? Let's let Hugh Beaumont explain this. Hugh? and dead on, dude, dead on. Stuff raising those kids
over the course of 6 years, six really crucial years, this show defined a very particular middle class coming of age trajectory in America in the 1950s. But what's interesting is you're talking about nostalgia now white people living in the suburb is not your nostalgia. but there is something universal about this for boomers. And you are a boomer.
I'm a boomer. Yeah. Right there. Yeah.
I am just on the cusp of, I'm the first year of Gen X. My wife, quite a bit younger, very much a Gen X.
Gen X, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a boomer.
And there is a generational shift there because by the time you get around to the Gen X moment, they're growing up with all of the single parent shows, right? They're growing up.
Bill Bixby over there. Oh, yeah.
George Bixby's father.
Even My Three Sons.
My Three Sons.
Yep.
Brady Bunch. Ghost and Mrs. Muir. You know, the Family Affair. I mean, on and on and on and on. The Partridge Family. Right. It's like suddenly divorce and broken families is more the norm than for Leave It to Beaver and Courtship of Eddie's or Donna Reed show.
Yeah.
Ozzie and Harriet. And right. That like the 50s thing blew up in the 60s and more so in the 70s. So it's a very interesting cultural shift there. But I will say that Leave It to Beaver is an amazing snapshot of a particular kind of television and a cultural moment. And over this course of 6 years, it really it does not repeat itself. You're right.
Beautiful parenting. I'm sorry, just beautiful parenting in that show. I loved it. Alf, on the other hand.
Oh, God.
Paul. What's his name? Fusco. Tom Patchett, Pichette, and their show.
I remember when this show was announced.
Yeah.
And you know, the TV Guide used to come out with the fall preview before there were 750,000 channels, when it was just three networks and, you know, it was manageable and you could put a little one page summary of all the new shows in the one little TV guide. And I would buy it every year and I'd read them and I'd memorize them and I'd figure out what shows am I going to watch. And darn it, those two shows are up against each other on Tuesday night. How am I going to deal with that? Because if only we had something that could record one show. That maybe some point in a space age future that miraculous technology will come around. But now I have to just choose one and maybe watch the other one in reruns during the summer. And ALF comes around. And I remember reading that and go, well, that'll get canceled mid-season. Son of a gun, it didn't. It ran for 4 seasons.
Yeah,
and it has spawned an animated series.
Yeah, yeah.
How did that happen? Tim, explain reality to me.
You tell me, man. 86 to 7. And I don't know. It's not like we hadn't had these you know, alien creature or weird creature in the family sort of things before. This is 86 to 90. I do not remember whether or not this precedes Harry and the Hendersons or not. They had like Bigfoot living with the family. And I suppose, you know, I mean, technically speaking, my favorite Martian had a Martian living with the dude. So, you know, we had to see, but this show here with this obnoxious ALF, alien life form, ALF, that was that, in this family, he wants the cat, and I don't know, dude. I really, really deeply hated this show.
It's the worst, but it's so beloved. The series deluxe edition. I know this is like we're recommending gifts, but and you know, a lot of people are going to love this. I hate it so much. It's just so terrible. The jokes are so terrible. The puppetry is so terrible. I just don't understand it, but it just, Americans disappoint me. Yeah, so we'll just, ALF doesn't warrant any further discussion. The people who love ALF are going to be cursing our names and threatening us on social media, and we won't care.
I'm a Farscape guy. I like Farscape.
Farscape. Yeah. So give us the pitch for Farscape, because I've never been heavily into it, but I've never watched a ton of it. This is the 25th anniversary collection on Blu-ray.
Yeah,
4 seasons and a whole bunch of bonus features that are just through the roof. But
a lot of animatronic puppets of your Jim Henson Company stuff. A really neat sort of story of this guy Ben Browder, who would go on to be on a part of the Stargate universe too, the lead in this show with Claudia Black, the extraordinary Claudia Black. It's just kind of this fun series that combined all of these things, this Jim Henson sort of puppetry sort of stuff on the spaceship and these sort of wicked sets with a neat storyline. Moya is this sort of large sort of biomechanical ship that's flying around, and Ben Browder's character is this astronaut who gets sucked through this wormhole into this other part of the galaxy where all of this wacky stuff is. And it's just a fun series that I always kind of dug.
Well, I'll tell you, it has a great following, and I found that out because I, you know, this is 99 to 2004, which was right around the time that there was where Richard Hatch was still alive. Mm. There was a big Battlestar Galactica convention in Universal City, and I went and I covered it, and I interviewed Richard Hatch at his apartment and the whole thing. And when I went to the convention itself, which was, you know, Nerdsville Central, I mean, it was very funny. But there was a ton of Farscape stuff. And it's like you go to a Battlestar Galactica convention and Farscape breaks out. Like, that was weird. But then I realized it's kind of the same fan base.
Yeah, yeah.
It sort of scratches the same itch in many respects.
Exactly. It's that sort of series that I dug a lot. Ben Browder, man, he's one of those guys. Him, Richard Dean Anderson, there are a few of them, Scott Bakula, who have spent the better part of 40 years always on television.
Yeah.
Always. You know, they never become, you know, Tom Cruise or whoever the equivalent, right. Brad Pitt, whoever the equivalent. But these guys have spent the better part of 40 years always on television.
And I have to say, before I forget, the one great story I have from that Battlestar Galactica convention, Galacticon or whatever it was called, was Patrick McNee. of the Avengers, who played, some people forget, he played Count Ebley, basically the devil, on an episode or a two-part episode of, or maybe three parts of Battlestar Galactica. And he showed up to sign pictures. Now, as usually happens at those conventions, people charge, right? That's what happens. It's cheesy, but like some washed up old star will, like, you pay him $5 and they'll sign their photo for you. And McNeese shows up. He's like 85, 87 is the time. He's an old guy, but he shows up and he sits down and they drop a stack of pictures in front of him. And he just starts signing away and people take, and some nerd actually like takes the picture and feels guilty for a second. He's like, do I pay you? And I'm standing like 2 feet away. I'm just watching this. I'm marveling at this thing, like, you know, an anthropologist watching gorillas. And McNee looks at him, pauses for a second, and says, "God, no, why would anyone want to pay me for my autograph?" He keeps on signing. I thought, okay, that's awesome. Now I'm really seriously impressed. He just showed up to just do his part for fandom, and he could have stayed home and just, you know, done nothing.
Yeah. I always appreciate that. It's the ethos that's a part of what's going on in your boy who wrote that wonderful Galaxy Quest.
Yes,
that's what's
it. Yep. Shall we? Let's do the 4Ks. We got so many amazing 4Ks, 4K steelbooks, box sets, the whole nine yards. The first one I got to point out, and there's a lot of stuff that, you know, they didn't send us, but this is the great 4K stuff they sent us. I will say, first of all, I hate Titanic. I've always hated Titanic. Here's when I knew, and I may have told this story before. Here's when I knew that Titanic was going to be like a massive, massive hit. So I'm sitting with my wife. We're at the, we're not married yet. We're still going, you know, in the pre-marriage thing, but we're sitting there at the Paramount Theater on the Paramount lot, right? Everyone's waiting for this screening. We're sitting up there kind of in the balcony-ish area. And this thing, we watched 3 hours and 15 minutes of this thing. And I had the Mark reaction to Napoleon, right? I was like, oh, huh. That was what I was saying to myself. And I thought, I don't know if this is really going to make any money. And then I hear,
yeah.
And
yeah.
I look over to my right, and there are these two gay guys that are literally clutching each other and sobbing.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, oh, I'm so not connected to what this is going to do.
No,
this is going to go through the roof. This is going to go through the roof. I was floored. I was floored. I was like, oh my gosh.
I was married in 1997. Had been for many, many years, and I should have kept my mouth shut about Titanic. That's what I should have done. Kept my mouth shut about how. I remember being irritated by this movie in a whole bunch of different ways and for a whole lot of different reasons. Not to mention some of that terrible CGI. That was terrible then and still terrible now. And of course, she let that brother freeze. Anyway, whatever.
I'm gonna tell you, this thing is out on a 4K 25th anniversary set with a digital code on it for Vudu or whatever you want, Apple. And even though I don't like this movie, this is a sweet set, man.
There you go.
15 hours of bonus content to go with that 3-hour movie. It'll take you a whole day to get through all this stuff. The documentary Titanic Stories from the Heart, which has all kinds of new stuff with Cameron and, you know, Kate Winslet and John Landau. It's really good. It's really good. The other stuff in here, a lot of it is, you know, just kind of silliness, like a ship schematic and, you know, some pre-production prop stuff, sheet music. None of this stuff is, who's going to play The Heart Goes On with the sheet music that you get in the 4K anniversary, 25th anniversary box set? Nobody. It's just stuff to kick the price up. But I'll tell you, it's a good looking film on 4K.
Yeah.
It's a good sounding film on 4K.
Yeah, this is the thing about Titanic, actually, that I would say. This marks the moment when Cameron chooses to move toward, deeply and in a very hard way, CGI. This marks that moment. And then for the ensuing 25 years, that's where he has lived, Avatar, blah, 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 all of that. As opposed to the Cameron that we knew prior to this from his Roger Corman days, certainly through even some of the latter, like The Abyss, Terminator 2, CGI in all of those places, but there was also stuff in those movies.
Yes.
Here is when he decides to just get all in. And you know, like Zemeckis did it around this time. Ang Lee did it for a few minutes around this time. And the result is some pretty terrible movies, some pretty terrible CGI. And I wonder what those films might have been like had they, you know, did the Irwin Allen thing. We just talked about Irwin Allen and just built something and blew it up.
True.
Yeah, true.
I mean, I feel like in many respects, those Irwin Allen movies we were just making fun of actually entertained me more.
Yeah, in a certain sort of way.
Poseidon Adventure still entertains me more than Titanic.
Yeah.
There is nothing in Titanic that I enjoy. All 3 hours and 15 minutes, there is not one single moment that is enjoyable as seeing Shelley Winters fall and go,
I like it when she makes that swim because, you know, I love it. That's so beautiful. So much pathos.
Oh, my gosh.
Of course, it kills her, but you know what the hell.
So there is also a 4K Ultra HD boxed set, a gnarly, huge box set of all six Resident Evil films.
Mm.
Now, I was a late comer to the whole Resident Evil thing, so there's a lot of eye rolling that went on and still goes on. The whole kind of future semi-apocalyptic, feministic, quasi-Mad Max-y, evil-y thing that's going on here. Umbrella Corp and, you know, Raccoon City and all this, you know, zombie. It merges a lot of things. It's like Mad Max and zombies and all this other stuff. There's just a lot of crap going on here. And ultimately, all it is just an excuse for a lot of CG-driven feminist superhero stuff with Mila Jovovich just, you know, kicking butt. That's basically it.
Yeah.
But six movies, man. They pushed this to six movies.
Yeah, that's nuts. And Mila was, hey, look, in those early, my homie Sherman, he was a big gamer.
Yeah.
And this is one of his. So, you know, he drugged me into this thing. And early on with Mila, I had a lot of fun with these movies. But six? No. And plus, I'll tell you what, you don't want to watch your hot superhero chicks age in cinema. That is not a good idea. Don't do it.
Well, what I love about this, and there's tons of extras here, I won't even get into it. I mean, it's just hours and hours of commentary and deleted scenes and documentaries and featurettes and everything else. I mean, just so much. So it's all fan driven. But this did that Friday the 13th thing where, you know, by the fourth film, they called the fourth film the final chapter. Remember Friday the 13th?
The final chapter.
Yeah, they were like 27 chapters after the final chapter. So we had Resident Evil, the final chapter, followed by Resident Evil Extinction. And after we had the final chapter and after they were extinct, I mean, final chapter and then Extinction. So Extinction came after the final chapter. Oh, no. Then we get Resident Evil Afterlife. Oh, for crying out loud. You know, that stuff just kills me. But anyway, it's all here. It is intensely.
Some of the stuff is in 3D, isn't it?
Not here.
Not here.
It's all 4K. No, there's no 3D with the 4K. It's just straight up 4K. So no 3D here. There may have been one that was a 3D, but anyway. And what I hadn't realized, to be honest, I was totally, I did not realize that Russell Mulcahy directed Extinction.
Oh, really? Russell, of course, the great, what was that great series that he did in the 80s?
Well,
Highlander. Yeah. The rock and roll. Yeah. With Chris.
Well, I hadn't realized that Mulcahy came out of his own Extinction.
Yeah.
Do Extinction. Really, so there it is.
Good for him. Yeah.
How do we feel about the Spider-Verse movies? We got a great box set here, like a really sweet Spider-Verse 2 movie box set.
Yeah.
Both of them. There's going to be a third one, obviously. And so you're going to get another box set. They're going to expect you to triple dip on when that comes around. This has a 7-inch vinyl record, comic book, art cards, and Miles sketchbook in it. So there's a lot of junk there that you're not going to want, like the 7-inch, you know, vinyl record they're sending us vinyl records like crazy.
Oh, dude, so much vinyl. Oh my God. Some of the stuff, the Oppenheimer score is just kind of great, actually. Because I have this whole wicked setup, turntable and all that. So the Spider-Verse stuff, I'm a big fan of that film. It's on the top of my list, near the top of my list of this year's animation. You got your sort of Boy in the Heron, that's sort of great Japanese. I got to tell you, but out of the American animated world, this movie here and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
See, you're a big fan of that. I watched that this week.
I thoroughly enjoyed both of these films.
I thought that the latest Spider-Verse movie, as frenetic and overwrought as it was, because I had a hard time following the plot. I don't even know what universe I'm in now. I'm bouncing between these things. But I thought it did a better job of telling the same story than the Flash.
Than the live action Flash, which was a mess. And this looks great, and the Flash did not look great. No. Attempting to do in live action what is naturally, what can naturally be done in this animation.
We have this fascinating 4K box set from Paramount, too, in addition to the co-Paramount, co-20th Century.
Paramount Titanic. Scares. I love it.
Paramount Scares Collection, which is volume one. Clearly, they are intending on taking a whole lot more of their various horror franchises and packing them up in future sections. Mm. So future volumes. So what we have here, very interesting. Rosemary's Baby from 1968, mm-hmm. Pet Sematary, the original from 1989, Crawl from 2019, 2022's Smile, and Sweeney Todd, the Tim Burton production from 2007. So these are this is quite interesting to me. Mm. The way that they're doing this. I mean, the only one that is of interest to me here is Rosemary's Baby. To be honest, I don't really care about the others. But if you're a horror buff, this is all of this stuff on 4K. This is a great way to go about it.
Yeah, I just look. It's some of these pairings don't make any sense to me, and that's always sort of bugged me when they do these things. If you're gonna do these things, I would like it. I don't know, some sort of a theme. They don't all have to be exact, but something that says these movies, Smile and Rosemary's Baby, somehow go together for some reason that makes some sort of sense. But they're not doing that exactly, so whatever. But still, good movies, relatively speaking.
So we've got a lot of Steelbook action on 4K too. So let me try to piece this together in a sensible way. So all four Expendable movies are out now. Now, at least, or maybe I should say three Expendables movies, because the fourth one is not called Expendables. It's called Expendforbles.
Yeah, that thing.
That stupid graphical choice, Expendforbles. So that is out, the fourth one, in just a regular 4K, Ultra HD 4K. Just I got it right here. And there's 50 Cent looking like he's put on about $1.50. And Yeah, he's kind of like,
on, dude, we're making a movie here.
Yeah,
let's get keto.
But you know what? Stallone got himself another franchise.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, there's a doc about Stallone out called, I think, Sly.
Yeah.
And it's interesting as he sort of walks through his career and all of these franchises. And it's just nuts that here he is again with this sort of legit franchise. And as most franchises do, they get less good by the movie. But nevertheless, another franchise.
Well, I mean, it has been fascinating to me how they have kept this going. And some of the people who show up in the fourth one, like Tony Jaa, shows up here.
Yeah.
Dolph Lundgren is there looking ridiculous, and Curtis Jackson is fine, and Stallone has had more work done. But boy, I'll tell you, seeing Tony Jaa show up was really pretty exciting to me. That was unexpected, and
Tony Jaa. He could watch a couple of, and look, I had fun with that. Yeah. Fourth film, whose plot was ludicrous, and all the stupid thing, the whole thing on a boat and a ship, and they got to stop and go world nuclear, all this kind of stuff. And but it's just a reason to put all these guys in a tight space and have them, beat the slop out of each other.
I will say the original, the first three films are now Best Buy Steelbook exclusives. Mm. And they're pretty steel books. And they, you know, there is some fun to the first one. I mean, it's got Bruce Willis, Jet Li being very fun, and Stallone and Terry Crews, and you know, Mickey Rourke. I mean, it is that first one is really quite fun. Jason Statham is kind of the unsung hero of these movies. He's the one that really holds it together, as far as I'm concerned. But then, you know, by the second time, you throw Schwarzenegger in there. The best part, bar none, of Expendables 2 is when they're cornered and all hell suddenly starts breaking loose. And who is it coming to their rescue? It's Chuck Norris. And he comes in, and he's got a few lines and a few one-liners, and he's out of there.
I loved it, baby.
That was great.
That's a great look. And by then, these movies are doing something more than just, you know.
Yes.
We're into the sort of cultural archive moment at this point, which is why a little disappointed haven't seen Mr. T. In the series. Now, Mr. T has had some health problems, but I think he's over most of that.
Snipes into the third one. They dragged Wesley Snipes into the third one.
No, if we're getting into these young guys, let's get some Mr. T in one of these suckers.
I mean, Ronda Rousey shows up in the third one. Harrison Ford, for crying out loud. It's just Mel Gibson. Good.
Yeah.
Kelsey Grammer. I mean, come on. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. It's become a thing where just showing up in one of these movies is just being a good sport.
That's what it is. Yep.
Also on Steelbook, we have got the Immortal Stand By Me, which is on 4K and talking about Rob Reiner again as a director. It holds up. It holds up. This is a lovely film. It's funny to see all of these actors before they grew up. It's a little sad seeing River Phoenix, knowing that he's no longer with us. Corey Feldman isn't cute anymore. Jerry O'Connell is, you know, he's Jerry O'Connell. But the movie really holds up and does right by the source material. And I, you know, can't say enough good things about it. It's got a lovely picture-in-picture commentary track with Rob Reiner and Corey Feldman and Will Wheaton. Some featurettes and a standalone audio commentary with Rob Reiner. And it's a good one.
The movie deeply moved by that movie way back in the day. Adapted from people forget sometimes, a little novella from Stephen King called The Body. It was very beautifully done.
Star Trek Strange New World season 2, dude. Sell me on this thing. I have tried.
That's really funny because people go well, I guess it would be true of Picard as well on this. You know, Larry Mantle, our film week colleague, he's a big fan of Strange New World. Believe it or not, I haven't seen a whole lot of Strange New World because it's over on Paramount Plus, and I don't always have Paramount Plus, so I was going to let them all stack up get caught up.
It is a beautiful steelbook. I will say that. It is beautiful. And the extras are copious. I just can't get into the characters. I can't. And the weird thing, too. So, right. The Critics Choice sends us, you know, well, not Critics Choice. They don't send us. But Paramount makes a lot of episodes available for those who vote for television stuff, which includes the Critics Choice. So we get to vote on that, too. And the episode they put forward is the musical.
The musical, episode. The one of the few that I actually saw.
What?
You know, some people love that episode like they love that Buffy the Vampire Slayer musical episode.
Yeah.
It is like the one that they love. I don't know. Interesting.
No, not on Star Trek. It was fine on The Love Boat. It was fine on Scrubs. Scrubs and The Love Boat are not Star Trek. Get together.
Now, in the musical episode, there's a reason for why they and this is what they're investigating and trying to. But so, you know, at least it's just not, you know. So I don't know. But there you go. Interesting.
Well, as long as we're on that here, we also have the Equalizer collection, a single case, 4K Equalizer 1, 2, and 3. Perfect. perfect. It's a small case, all three movies, great Christmas gift. Denzel kills it. The movies are all basically the same, but we talked about this. We like the third one.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. A lot of Godfather in that movie. Right. You know, look good. Denzel having fun. With the notion of being this guy. Yes. Really, really neat stuff.
And we talked about this last week, but we want to recommend it again in the 4K section, the 60th anniversary 4K of Godard's Le Mépris, otherwise known as Contempt, along. And you can get it in a box set with the Blu-ray as well. The regular 4K does not include a Blu-ray, as most of them usually do. So you got to make sure you get the little box set with the previous Blu-ray and the 4K, but if you want them both, but it's great. Also, a couple of Christmas-themed 4K titles. Scrooged with Bill Murray.
Yeah.
It's perfectly fine. I don't know if it screams for 4K, but it's there.
It's a movie that I always loved. And that movie was a big flop at the time, but it's a movie that I always appreciated.
It has really risen in estimation.
It's one of those moments, yeah.
And then last year's surprise kind of hit, Violent Night.
Yeah.
Which is basically Die Hard with Santa. And David Harbour playing Santa and bringing the Stranger Things is goody, and that's what it is. It's Die Hard with Santa, and Santa's a badass, and it's actually kind of fun.
Yeah,
I sort of enjoyed it more so than the Mel Gibson thing the 2 years ago.
That angry Santa movie, whatever.
So a few other classics here to just roll through on 4K. So, oh my gosh, it just doesn't stop. I want to get down to two very particular down here at the end, but American Graffiti 50th Anniversary Edition 4K, The Fugitive, part of the Warner Brothers 100th Anniversary series 4K. Tons of great extras there. Beautiful transfers both. Point Break from Shout Factory.
Wow. What's that? 30 for Point Break? 30?
Isn't that crazy? Isn't that crazy? It's number 151 of their Shout Select line. Beautiful two disc 4K Blu-ray set. The original Young Guns gets the 4K treatment. Emilio Estevez, Kiefer Sutherland again from Stand By Me, a little older.
Yeah.
Dermot Mulroney, Casey Shamasco, Lou Diamond Phillips, and Charlie Sheen. The original Young Guns. Better movie today than I gave it credit for at the time, I got to be honest.
All of those guys did great.
And Stephen King's Silver Bullet, not great, but you know, I mean, in the moment when everything was Stephen King, and again, we have Corey Haim here, as long as we're on the Corey thing, it sort of fills in that body of work from that period of time.
Well, it was a lesser Stephen King book. This is from the movie's 1985. I forget exactly when the book came out, but it's a lesser Stephen King book, and it made a lesser Stephen King movie. But again, it's in a certain sort of way. I'm nostalgic about it. Ridiculously nostalgic about the movie. Yeah.
And then lastly, a couple of more recent 4Ks, Saw X or Saw 10, more of Jigsaw and that nastiness. That's on 4K. For people who want that for Christmas.
Who would have thought 20 years of those freaking movies?
Oh my God.
20 years. The first one was 2004, yeah.
And Daniel Radcliffe on 4K playing Al Yankovic in Weird, the Al Yankovic story. A little strange, a little over the top, as I think it's supposed to be.
Yeah. I enjoyed it. What can I tell you? I love the way it plays loose, fast and loose with the truth. And in other words, there's not a single moment of anything in this movie that has anything to do with an actual biography of Weird Al Yankovic.
I know, that's what's a little.
And that's just
either funny or annoying, depending on how you slice it.
when they're in Dr. What's his name's backyard, and everybody shows up.
So let's tell
that's
a crazy scene.
That's a nutty scene, man.
So let's spend a moment here at the end here, because we got two really, really terrific 4Ks now from Warner Brothers here. One from Universal, one from Warner Brothers. So one from someone who used to work for Warner Brothers, which is kind of what I want to get into. I'm jumping the gun here on my own stuff. So both of these have Oscar relevance this year. One is a movie that is going to be very high and may in the race and may win everything and really upset Warner Brothers. And the other one is a movie that has now been effectively not, I would say, remade, but is in the mix again. So first, let's talk about The Color Purple, the Steven Spielberg film with Whoopi Goldberg, which was nominated for like 11 or 12 Academy Awards at the time, and it won none of them. It went 0 for everything. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Oprah, before she lost a considerable amount of weight, is got a nomination for this and is terrific in it. And but this was, you know, here's the thing. I love the new musical. Truly love it. I didn't love this film at the time. And the music.
The 1980 whatever film. Yes,
which five, is gorgeous film, on 4K. I mean, look, Spielberg directs the hell out of it. It's shot beautifully. Alan Davial just shoots the daylights out of it. Danny Glover brings it. Oprah brings it. Margaret Avery is just terrific in this film. But I don't necessarily like the film itself. I can appreciate it, and tell me if you think I'm totally off base here, because I didn't read the book until after I saw this movie, and I realized that the book is really a great piece of modern American literature. It's wonderful historical fiction. It's very elegiac. It's that. And the movie to me felt like Spielberg thought, oh, what a great opportunity for me to do a little John Ford here, a little George Stevens here, a little Stanley Kramer over here. And it feels like he's using this story, like he's using Alice Walker's story as a hobby horse or like a clothes horse to sort of hang a lot of his stylistic cinema heroes on. And it becomes saddled, burdened with this preciousness. And I didn't feel like it came alive. The new one does.
The musical, which has been out for, I think it's been on Broadway for a good little bit now.
2006. 2006, and then they revived it in 2015.
Yeah. And that, you know, in the book, this is the difference. So 1985, The Color Purple, this film here. In the black community, it was this very important film adapted from this very important Alice Walker book. It was a part of our, you know, and we went to see this film and we were left mostly feeling two ways. The film The Color Purple, when you watch it as a black man, and I was, you know, relatively speaking, a black man at the time. I was 24 years old, but I'd been married a few years, and there was not a single sympathetic black male character in that film, right? The beautiful, the wonderful Caesar. What was his name? It'll pop into my head. All of these people, Danny Glover, not a single. And this was an issue. It's not true of the book, by the way. So choices were made. And the choices that were made, gave us a film shaped in this way. And to be honest with you, it's left a bad taste in my mouth for more than for almost 40 years.
I'm going to tell you something in a second.
Thank you very much. Now, this the musical, which, you know, people have, but the musical erases that bad taste.
Yes,
and when people talk about The Color Purple henceforth and forever, when I get to, you know, make recommendations, I've never shown this The Color Purple in any class I've ever taught. The new Color Purple, the musical, I will be showing for the rest of my life.
Let me tell you something really interesting. So that screening that Mark and Vivian and I went to at the Academy, right, where everybody cheered for the movie and the whole thing. And then, you know, Blitz Bazoule, the director, just like the most charismatic man. I it's unbelievable. He has this mellifluous voice and he speaks very softly and he just captures everybody. He's very charismatic. So I can see why he's a good director, because he magnetizes you. And he goes up there with Oprah and the whole cast and he lets the cast go crazy. And Colman Domingo, you know, star of Rustin as well, comes out in this just fantastic white suit. And at one point, Colman starts talking about how when they were doing certain scenes, and he and the young actor who plays
one of the male actors,
because
it's Corey Hawkins who plays Harpo.
Corey Hawkins.
Okay, yeah, yes. Corey. Yeah.
So he was talking about scenes that he had with Corey Hawkins, where they were doing scenes together, and he turned to Blitz and he says, "Let us just do it a few more times. We're getting somewhere. We're getting to something, right? I mean, this is a great stage actor who realizes you workshop it, you get to an emotional place. He said, because we wanted to get to something about Black men, because we felt like we had a responsibility in this film. And I'm paraphrasing what he was saying. It wasn't a dry eye in the house. He said, I feel like, especially in the present time, we had a responsibility to talk to the dignity of Black men and to show that even in the most, in the worst circumstances, and even under the worst things, that even what these men do, there is still some saving grace to them. There is still some dignity. There is something there. And they wanted to get to that in their scenes together. And the fact that he as an actor was so, had the presence of mind to say, I want to get to this. He's not just playing an evil bastard.
Yeah, you can't.
You can't. This is a guy who is subject to all kinds of human complexities. And he wanted to get work there with Corey and really drill down and get to that. And they were both in tears by the time they were done. And that, to hear him talk about that, I thought that there it is. It's exactly what you're talking about. There's humanity. They bring a humanity to that film that I felt disappeared in all of Spielberg's stylistic obsessions in the first one.
Yeah, it was, and you look, choices. You know, there's a Mister. Danny Glover in this film.
And Coleman
in the other films. Yeah. Mr. at the end of this film, the 1985 film.
Yes.
That little transition.
Yes. Right?
And I'm like, if I had felt any of that across the arc of this film, then this is a film that I love. Yeah. Mr. Coleman, Domingo's Mr. There's something all the way through. So there you go. Anyway, it's not like I hate the color purple.
I don't either. But I mean, look, I love that Quincy Jones score. It's lush. It's just beautiful. It's fantastic. But anyway, let's move on now to the film of the year, likely to be the film of the Oscars, Oppenheimer, which is selling out everywhere. You've heard this, right?
Yeah.
You can't find this on 4K. What I have in my hands, I could probably pay off my mortgage with this. I could take this 4K and I could just auction it and it would sell to a sheikh somewhere in Dubai. This is astonishing. This thing is selling out everywhere. People are jumping all over this. So it didn't just make $950 million. This thing was originally expected to make about $250 million, maybe three. Mm-hmm. It more than tripled. It's 3 hours long. It's a biopic. Takes place in most people who would go to see this movie hadn't heard of this guy. And I don't buy the Barbenheimer argument that like a bunch of, 20 something girls are going to go see Barbie and then say, okay, now let's go see the 3 hour movie about the atomic bomb guy. And well, no, it's not going to happen. And we found out those are two totally different audiences.
Yeah, the audiences are very, very different.
They were animated by the same sort of publicity, but these are different audiences. So what is it? I mean, this thing's flying off the shelf now. People still love it. What is it about this movie?
It's an interesting thing. Okay, now, and I will speak to it as a person who appreciates this movie, but doesn't love it.
I'm with you.
I think it's just one of the things that we started talking about before the show, but I deeply appreciate this movie. Christopher Nolan's screenplays, and he wrote this one all by himself as opposed to with his brother, which he sometimes does. Now, Christopher Nolan has this tendency to write things and have people say them. And I mean all of them. And that's true of this movie too. People say things in this movie that people don't. There's dialogue, as much as a visual director as he is, my Lord, somebody should just be like, Chris, all of these sentences need to go away and stop having these people say these things. Now this is a personal, now I'm going to get to a personal thing. I think that's a perfectly valid critical critique that I just made about his screenplays, period. Now this is the personal thing I'm going to say now. This particular film, Oppenheimer, who did what he did and is venerated for that, and the story about how he got there, all of that, very interesting. Very interested in that, I am personally. What I'm not terribly interested in is the soap opera of Oppenheimer's life, his existence. his infidelities.
Naked Oppenheimer?
Yeah, naked Oppenheimer. You're sitting, you know, I have no interest in any of that at all. This film is very it's very interested. I was going to say obsessed, but I won't say that. This film is very interested in that. It's very interested in the patent place. Mm-hmm. Same thing in Maestro, which is more patent place behind much of that.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm not. This film is very interested in that story that it tells about Strauss, the character that Robert Downey Jr. plays. This film is very interested in that and framed it in this very particular way, most of which, I'm sorry, it's just made up.
Yeah.
It's just made up. It's just bullshit drama developed in Christopher Nolan's head about these men and the thing going on. To my mind, this film gets in its own way with a whole bunch of personal drama that obscures the actually interesting thing that this movie is about, which is the development of that fucking atomic bomb.
So, ladies and gentlemen, you have heard it now from Mr. Tim Cogshell that we don't need naked Oppenheimer and we don't need naked Bernstein.
No.
That's the theme of today's show. No naked Oppenheimer, no naked Bernstein.
All you boys, keep your clothes on.
Well, it is. Nolan has been very upfront about how important it is. He thinks that people own the disc so that no streaming service can steal it from us. And there's not a lot by way of special features on here, to be honest. There's a making of thing, and there's a Q&A panel and some featurette-y stuff, Movies Anywhere Code. But on balance, this is really just the movie. That's really what you're getting. The special features, yeah, I mean, there's a ton of special features, but they're not. It's nothing remarkable.
Can you isolate the score?
That's a great question. I did not go that deep. It's mostly making up stuff.
The score for this, who's it? It's that kid, Ludwig Göransson, I think.
And the special features are all Blu-ray. They're not 4K. Only the movie is 4K. You get the special features, which you don't need the special features on a 4K. But but you're basically getting the movie, and I suspect that there will be a more elaborate special edition somewhere in the offing. Some bargain stuff from Mill Creek. Let me just kind of blow through this real quickly. These are multi-sets, right? Stuff that throw a bunch of movies on one disc for people who just, you know, it's a nice affordable gift for people who love these kinds of things. They got the Vault collection from Mill Creek. There's the sci-fi from the Vault, which is 20 Million Miles to Earth, Creature with the Atomic Brain, It Came from Beneath the Sea, and the 30-Foot Bride of Candy Rock. It is all schlocky junk except for It Came from Beneath the Sea, which is a whole lot of fun. Mm-hmm. But you know what? I mean, there are reasons to watch the others as well. Lou Costello is in the 30-Foot Bride of Candy Rock. It's silly. But there it is, you know, late 1950s kind of atomic nonsense. Creature with the Atomic Brain is all right as well. We have another Thrillers from the Vault, 8 movies. Some pretty good stuff in here. Boris Karloff shows up, Bela Lugosi shows up. There's The Black Room, The Man with 9 Lives, Return of the Vampire, Before I Hang is a really good movie. The Man They Could Not Hang
is that movie, man.
So I mean, there's some fun stuff. There's some, you know, good old fashioned. I mean, a lot of Boris Karloff here, but Lugosi shows up in The Return of the Vampire, so that's worth a look. Then we've got Jude Law in Black Sea and Russell Crowe in State of Play. That's a nice little director spotlight combination here. So, you know, both of these from, I don't remember the years.
Oh, Black Sea. Let's see. Black Sea is going to be when? 2014-ish, something like that.
Yeah.
The Kevin MacDonald film, right?
Yeah. Both of these are Kevin MacDonald.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, and then we have on DVD, Robert Duvall in The Apostle and Tom Berenger and a whole bunch of other people in At Play at the Fields of the Lord. I'm lukewarm on The Apostle. It was a little too showy for me, but At Play in the Fields of the Lord, fantastic. Saul Zantz and Hector Babenko. Wonderful movie. Great music by Zbigniew Priesner. You should see it on DVD or on Blu-ray, but a DVD will do if it's a bargain thing. bargain.
The apostle gave Farrah Fawcett a chance to act. And every blue moon, Robert Altman did it with her in that one with Richard Gere. Every blue moon late in her career, somebody would come along and give the Farrah Fawcett a chance to act. And she always rose to the occasion.
Yes, she did. We have another director spotlight here. Four films on DVD. Don't necessarily need these on Blu-ray because they're not those kinds of films. These are movies from Neil LaBute.
Neil, oh my God, Neil. I haven't thought about him in a long time.
I know. He's
probably why I haven't been depressed in a while.
Yeah. Well, he has Nurse Betty, which is that's a little curious for him. The Shape of Things and Your Friends and Neighbors, which are pretty depressing. And then Obsession, which I thought was an absolutely lovely film with Aaron Eckhart and Gwyneth Paltrow.
Beautiful love story. Yeah.
Wonderful love story. A little bit of a kind of a present, past, you know, dark shadows, kind of a skipping through time thing. But really, I thought it was a wonderful movie. I think it might even be my favorite of his films. So those are all on a DVD. And then on Blu-ray, some other collections. We've got a four-film comedy collection of mostly Peter Falk stuff, The Cheap Detective, Big Trouble, Happy New Year, and Love. Yeah. And you are really seeing this primarily for The Cheap Detective. Peter Falk made Big Trouble, Happy New Year, and Love as he's just not remembered for those. But The Cheap Detective is probably alone worth grabbing this and giving it to somebody you love. We have Richard Pryor in Which Way Is Up? And the Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars and Motor Kings, which I had totally forgotten even existed. Also has Billy Dee Williams and James Earl Jones in it. I love Which Way Is Up. I think Pryor
he's doing that Eddie Murphy thing of playing all those characters. Yeah. Well, 10 years before Eddie Murphy.
Yeah. And kind of at the same time as Peter Sellers was making a thing, and no one else was daring to do it. And he does it so well.
Yeah.
The Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars and Motor Kings, dude, that was produced by Rob Cohen.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
That is so strange. I love Richard's bit because he's trying to break into, you know, you got the Negro Leagues and Richard's character is trying to break into the major leagues before anybody else. And he tries to break into the major leagues as a Cherokee Indian. It's just hysterical. No, all the things he does, it's just really, really great.
The weird thing, I mean, this was a very strange, the Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars and Motor Kings is a very strange movie because it came out, I didn't see it at the time, I saw it years later, but John Badham directed this, the same year he did Saturday Night Fever, that's why it fell between the cracks. Rob Cohen produced it for him, and executive producer Berry Gordy.
Yeah.
That's just a weird bunch of people to be working together.
particularly on that movie. I mean, you know, I mean, that's almost as weird. I always thought it was a little weird that Sidney Lumet directed The Wiz, but there was like a lot of that going on back then, I guess.
Well, and then to wrap this out, we've got a Double Danger 2 movie collection of Waist Deep and Drop Squad. Neither of these movies are, I don't know why Spike Lee presented Drop Squad. I guess, you know,
it was a culture thing.
I don't know. Anyway, Eric LaSalle, Vonnie Curtis Hall are better than the material warrants. Waist Deep is basically just an early vehicle for Tyrese Gibson to do some stuff. We also have White Noise and White Noise 2. The first one with Michael Keaton, the second one with Nathan Fillion. They obviously didn't have a budget to go and get Michael Keaton to come back. Mm-hmm. I don't think either of these are particularly great, but you know they have a following. Otherwise, it wouldn't be out there. The Music and Romance 6 movie collection, which has some surprisingly decent stuff in it. It's got Shout with Travolta, Captain Corelli's Mandolin with
Penelope Nick Cruz Cage.
And Nick Cage, right?
Yeah.
Connie and Carla is not such a great movie. It's, you know, meh. It's okay. The Man Who Cried with Johnny Depp is meh. You know, John Turturro's the best thing about that. Caveman's Valentine.
Right. Samuel L. and Cassie and all. Yeah,
that was a significant indie. And then Madame Suzatska.
Oh, yeah.
With Shirley MacLaine.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful late Shirley MacLaine there. Yeah.
Yeah, so you know, this is a really good set. Captain Corelli's Mandolin, Caveman's Valentine, and Madame Suzatska are three legit indie movies from a certain period that are worth having in your collection.
Yeah,
and then lastly, four epic showdown action movies: The Cowboy Way, Kull the Conqueror, The Jackal, and End of Days. Nothing great here. The Cowboy Way is just kind of a silly buddy. There's really no reason these four movies should ever be together in any way whatsoever. but Kiefer Sutherland, Woody Harrelson in The Cowboy Way, kind of silly. The Jackal, yeah, you know, it's Gere and Willis doing a thing, and then Schwarzenegger fighting Satan in End of Days is utterly ridiculous. But you know what? I mean, one of these movies will appeal to somebody. We've got some silent stuff. We got a couple anime things, and we got a bunch of Christmas movies that are interesting. Let me roll through the Christmas titles.
Let's do some Christmas.
So we got a Holiday Collection 3-1 here: Christmas with the Knightleys, Christmas in Big Sky Country, and Christmas in Maple Hill. These are all exactly the same. Really, really just pretty young performers who are celebrating Christmas and learning lessons. Mm. I'm sure someone will love to put that on the background when they have their party going. I am not one of them. You know what? I misfiled this one. I should have mentioned this with the movie boxes. Let's take a step aside.
Okay. We
have the complete Police Academy collection.
Oh, yeah. Michael Winslow popped up earlier.
I mentioned this earlier, and I thought I had that. Yeah. I just misplaced it here in the stacks. No. The Police Academy, you get a complete film collection. So 150 in the Shout Select line. And you can watch all the Police Academy movies if you dare. They wonderful new scans of all of them. We're talking seven films total, and I'm kind of amazed that there were seven films. They ended with Police Academy Mission to Moscow. That was the last one. And what's weird, Tim, here's what's weird. They figured out their audience.
Yeah.
Because I didn't realize this until I kind of did a little bit of research. Police Academy was an R-rated movie.
The first one, yeah.
Police Academy 2 was PG-13.
Okay.
The rest of them are PG.
Oh, yeah. So they just, there you go. Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Because I remember seeing the original Police Academy. Seven movies, seven directors, by the way. Nobody came back.
I know.
As they became. That was an R-rated movie, that Police Academy at the drive-in. A little bit of nudity in that movie. There you go. Yeah, interesting.
And created by Hugh Hudson, who created WKRP in Cincinnati as well. Mm-hmm. So there we go. So the complete Christmas collection of The Office. They do this every once in a while, and they decided to put together all the Christmas shows from The Office, which is a bunch. There are seven of them, seven Christmas shows. And you know what? I never really cared for The Office, the American version of this, but the Christmas shows are pretty funny.
Interesting.
There's a real thing that they had going. It's just a little bit. It's just cynical enough that it feels more like the Ricky Gervais thing.
Yeah, there's from seasons 2, 3, 5, 6, and 7, or from which they draw these films, these episodes.
A Christmas Story Christmas. This is the sequel, Ralphie Comes Home. Did you see this?
No, because why would you? But okay. Because, you know, it's a sequel, man. And I'm sorry, A Christmas Story is we're done. It's perfect.
I don't know what possessed them. It's not charming. It's not. It just don't sully your memories of the original.
Yeah, Peter Billingsley and all the people we love. Melinda, the lovely Melinda, who
Melinda Dillon. Elmo's Holiday Spectacular, The Nutcracker, and Other Tales. This is just a lot of Sesame Street holiday stuff. Animated Elmo, regular Elmo, Maya Angelou working with Elmo to save Christmas. It's a lot of it's just very, very sweet, but it's for little kids. My daughter hasn't been into Elmo since for quite a while now. Hallmark three movie collection, just like that first three movie collection. Christmas with Holly, Silver Bells, and One Christmas Eve, which is It's okay. I don't know what to say about all this stuff. They just keep pumping these things out. Yeah. The only thing that's interesting here is that Christmas with Holly was directed by, of all people, Alan Arkush.
Yeah.
That's weird to me that he's gone to directing like Hallmark movies. Is that what it's come to now?
First of all, let's be honest. There's money in these movies.
I know.
Yeah, there's a lot of money in these movies. It's a little cottage industry of these movies that get made and live and exist in these certain sort of spaces. And for a while there was a little rancor in the black community because there weren't enough of these movies that, you know, were. And now there's a whole second little cottage industry of these movies full of black people.
Funny you mention that, because I have here Christmas in Evergreen. Bells are ringing.
There you go.
With Holly Robinson Pete. Holly Robinson, who was a year ahead of me in school. We were on TV together when I was in fourth grade and she was in fifth. Now that's gonna be my claim to fame forever. You know, when Holly was I was a TV at
the same dude. I wish I could say that.
Yeah, it was an interesting moment in childhood. Holly and Rukia Barnard, Ashley Williams, mm-hmm. Barbara Niven. It's a sweet look. Holly can still act. Yes. I'm not gonna take anything away from her. She's not doing much of it anymore. She can still act.
Yeah, you can still act.
So there it is. And directed by Linda Lisa Hayter, whoever she is. God bless you. You got a gig.
Yeah.
And then we also have another one of these on Blu-ray called A Magical Christmas Village with Allison Sweeney and Luke McFarlane. This is also from Hallmark. It's like crazy that they just crank these things out. I don't know what their Christmas movie budget is, but anyway, this is, you know, just family struggling with all kinds of issues and Christmas saves them.
Yeah.
And then Lacey Chabert stars in Haul Out the Holly.
I love Lacey Chabert.
Yeah. And I thought, oh, does that mean her name is Holly? No, no. Her name's Emily, actually. It would be funnier if her name was Holly.
Oh, my God. She's 41 years old now.
I know. Is that crazy?
That's insane. Okay. Anyway, that's crazy. Yeah.
So the actual plot of this is one of the few that is actually kind of funny. And there's a reason why it's funny. So the idea is that she has to spend Christmas alone in her parents' house, and the homeowners association starts harassing her to do all this Christmas stuff. And you know, that's pretty funny. And you know why it's funny? Because Andy Samberg wrote it.
Andy Samberg,
Haul Out the Holly. Andy Samberg wrote it. Everybody's getting in on the action.
Eddie Murphy has a big one that's streaming someplace right now.
Yes, it's the Netflix thing. Candy Cane Lane.
Yes. I mean, dude, they drug Eddie Murphy into a Christmas movie.
Near as I can tell, and I haven't followed the plot necessarily because I haven't wanted to, but near as I can tell, Eddie discovers that Santa is black. That's the plot. I believe that's the plot, which is brilliant.
I discovered that in 1963.
They had that too in the original. They had all the different Santas in the original Frosty the Snowman, and then Tony Danza and Thompson and the late Betty White in Christmas.
Oh yeah.
Which, you know, it's not great, but Betty White's in it. And so I cut it a lot of slack. Anyway. And then a bunch here just to kind of wrap things out. Mrs. Brown's Boys, Holly Jolly Jingles. Mm-hmm. This is an utterly strange, I've never seen the show. It's on Bach Picks, I guess. Anyway. So if you've ever seen Mrs. Brown's Boys, I suppose this is going to really, really make you just long for Christmas. But I guess it's a BBC thing. It's a British tongue-in-cheek comedy thing.
Yeah.
A Very Merry Movie Collection from Lifetime, Volume 6, believe it or not. This is just unbelievable. This has all kinds of Christmas romance in it. Straight romance, gay romance, all colors of romance.
Gotta love
Christmas romance, black romance, white romance. It's just everybody getting to love each other on Christmas on Volume 6. And there are 12.
Volume 6? Oh, my God.
Volume 6. 12 of these crazy movies. Oh, they just can't get enough of them. Got another, let's see, another one. Last one here is An Angelic Christmas. Christmas miracles come in small packages. And this is kind of sweet. It's not great, but it's all right. And this is from Pure Flix.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit more wholesome than the other stuff. It's a little bit more faith adjacent, I think, is what they say.
Yeah, it's very, there's an actual angel in it. So it's right in there.
A little girl's lost her dad, and an angel comes down to earn her wings, It's a Wonderful Lifestyle, and it's got all that stuff.
I thought it was great. Yeah,
it's very sweet. So there is that. We're right here at the end, and let me pull out a few other things here that might be of interest to people for the holidays. There are some great old classic movies from Warner Archive Collection. We'll cover some of the rest of these another time. But the ones I want to make mention of are the ones that really have some wonderful classic credentials to them. Joan Crawford and Dance Fools Dance.
Oh, yeah.
Great old MGM title from the early 30s. Young Joan Crawford. Joan.
Clark Gable, young Bill Holden, young every damn body. Yes.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Elvis and Double Trouble, also for MGM. A lot of the Warner Archive stuff, obviously from the MGM library, because they inherited it. This is from Norm Taurig, and just a good classic Elvis shake your hips kind of thing. Howard Hawks' Land of the Pharaohs, good, widescreen period thing that, great music from Dmitri Tiomkin. It's a little cheesy, but it's ancient Egypt and, all the salacious stuff.
Oh, young Joan Collins.
We're doing that.
Let's do it. Yeah.
The animated Cats Don't Dance, which I am going to show to my daughter one of these nights, is just absolutely delightful. One of the few kind of non-Disney animated films from the 90s that was actually worth watching. This was made for television originally as a TNT thing, but it's really very, very sweet. And it's got some great songs by Randy Newman. And it's terrific.
You got your Don Knotts voicing in there.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, you got Scott Bakula and the wonderful Jasmine Guy from your voices in there. So, not voices that you hear all the time.
Yeah, it's very, very sweet. Very, very sweet. Love that. Got Clark Gable and Jean Harlow in Saratoga, which is, it's so much Hollywood star power here. Great MGM film from 1937, just before he went to go make Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
It really, really is. It's absolutely terrific. Another big MGM spectacle, Westward, The Women.
Oh, yeah.
Which was produced by Dori Sherry, the great Dori Sherry, directed by legendary William Wellman, who had done All Quiet on the Western Front. Mm-hmm. And great score from Max Steiner. But what I hadn't realized was that the story was cooked up by Frank Capra, which is interesting because Frank Capra was working for Columbia at the time. So this must have been something that Capra had sold years earlier, and it just worked its way through the system.
Oh, yeah. Henry Nakamura is in that film. One of the few films from that era where you see a Japanese actor in a sort of serious role and doing important things. I really appreciated that about that film.
A more fun Elvis movie is Spin Out, which has just the best rear screen projection scenes of him sitting in an absolutely still race car and he's not moving, but man, he's pretending to move really well.
Yeah, he's just
it's so funny. Also directed by Norman Taurig, but a really fun film. Good music. Elvis is not a race car driver.
No,
this is not. But Shelley Fabares is so gorgeous in this.
Oh my God.
So fantastic. Spencer Tracy, Joan Bennett, and Elizabeth Taylor in Father's Little Dividend, the sequel to Father of the Bride, which is equally wonderful. Directed by Vincent Minnelli, just like the first one was. Absolutely spectacular. Just a beautiful, beautiful film. And then the last three here, these are the ones that I love so much. Gay Paris with the voice of Judy Garland. a beautiful movie. So much fun. 1962, a Warner Brothers animated film, kind of like their version of the Aristocats. But, you know, this is written by Chuck Jones and his wife, directed by Abe Levitow.
Great voices all over that movie.
Robert Goulet. Oh, my gosh. So good. Red Buttons.
Yeah.
Really a fun film. Totally worthy of Disney stuff at the time. Paul Muni in The Life of Emile Zola, one of the great early biopics. More great music from Max Steiner. Just a terrific film from 1937 as well. I think he may have won an Oscar for this. I think he may have won Best Actor. Mm. And then lastly, it doesn't get more Christmas than this. The original wonderful black and white Little Women with Katharine Hepburn, Joan Bennett, Paul Lucas, Gene Parker, directed by George Cukor. Really just a priceless classic. There have been so many good versions of this, but this one just really, really captures the spirit of it. Marion C. Cooper was the executive producer of this. A lot of people don't realize that. Cooper and Shodzak.
You know, 1933. This is one of the earliest, if not the earliest, right?
Yes, it is. It is very much the earliest sound version. There may have been a silent, but But Marion C. Cooper produced this, you know, the King Kong fame. So, pretty great movie. Pretty great adaptation. Really, really captures the spirit. So there is all of that. And maybe I'll mention just a couple of these anime things. Yeah. There's the familiar of Zero, the complete series from Sentai that makes a really great gift for people who like, you know, anime that focuses on young girls looking a little bit overly cute. If you're not too prurient, there it is. And then I'm not even going to start to get into the Evangelion saga, but Hideaki Anno's Evangelion 3.0 plus 1.11 Thrice Upon a Time.
I love it.
Crazy, right? It's just crazy. But it's got a theatrical release and did very well worldwide. Yeah. This is Blu-ray and 4K on this thing. This is from Shout. And it's quite a nice package, and this really nice custom packaging here. Evangelion as a universe, as a saga, is just vast.
And
it's another one of those giant world building exercises in anime that is just impossible to you know outline. But this is kind of the conclusion to a particular part of this part of the saga. So it's not where you should start your Evangelion, but it's a good place to end it and to break your habit. So if you've been watching a lot of Evangelion, work your way to Evangelion 3.0 plus 1.11 Thrice Upon a Time. and this is part of the rebuild of Evangelion saga, which is like four films long. So work your way to that four film saga and then call it quits. Call it cold turkey. Don't fall off the wagon again. You'll be good. You'll be happier for it. Tim, you headed home for the holidays?
I'm going to definitely spend some time across Christmas in St. Louis, but I'm going to go early so that I don't have to deal with any of that, and then I'm going to come back late so I don't have to deal with any of that. But I'll kind of be there. Not back on the radio for a minute, man.
Yeah, well, I'm on the 15th, so I'm going to be covering American Fiction and Wonka.
Oh, beautiful.
And what else am I covering? Oh, and
give us a preview of Wonka, because I still need to see Wonka. And, you know, I didn't look that Johnny Depp situation from a few years ago. I know Charlie and Chocolate Factory, whatever. I think Willy Wonka, and I think Gene Wilder, and I think I'm done.
Wonka is, you know, Paul King directed it, and I love Paul King. He's the guy behind the Paddington films. Mm-hmm. So wonderful. I think it's a little bit more of a gig for hire here. I don't think they let him have the free reign he should have had. It's not terrible. It's fine. Mm. It's fine. It should do fine. I think it should do fine. But we'll see if people have an appetite for it. It is more a prequel to the Gene Wilder film than
prequel to the Gene Wilder film.
Yes, that's what it basically is. That's what it slots in as. We're pretending that the Johnny Depp film never existed, and that's just as well.
No, yes, yes, indeed.
Just as well. So either way, I will be seeing you at voting on Sunday.
I'll be there, man.
All right, man. We'll stake out some territory in the back and try not to make fun of everybody too much.
I love it. Okay.
All right. If we don't come, we have some things we'd like to try to do before the holidays completely wrap out, some special things. Don't know if we'll get around to it because we've got some full plates. But if we don't, then just an unbelievably wonderful holiday to everybody. We'll see you the next time.
Where it's snowing all winter through, that's where I want to be. Snowball throwing, that's what I'll do. I'm longing to ski. Snow, those glistening houses that seem to be built of snow.
Christmas with no snow.